Shooting it raw?
Yes. Shooting it raw.
Actually, in a few years back, I opened my own photography business. Did photography in St. Louis for a while, mostly kind of corporate stuff. And I don't know, like I started it as something that I just really loved taking pictures. And that's actually why I quit it as well, because I loved taking pictures and I stopped loving it so much after I started getting paid for it. So photography for me has always been a kind of a love-hate relationship because sometimes I love to travel, and sometimes I'll purposely travel without any camera or any way of recording anything, and sometimes I'll travel just to take the pictures. So it's the duality there is a very real thing for me.
Nice. Lance, look, first of all, welcome to the podcast, Shooting It Raw. I'm going to see if we're going to somehow dance around this idea that we're given this finite number of seconds in our lives. And like, how do we make every second count? If life really is a gift. I know nothing about you. So your name is Lance Aksamit.
Yep, Lance Aksamit.
Aksamit. Okay, Aksamit. What is Aksamit? I've never seen that name before.
Yeah, no, it's if you ever see one, there's a good chance I'm related to them. It is a old Czech name, actually.
Okay.
So, yeah, my father's family is from Bohemia, and a lot of them came back from this. Actually, I'm related somehow to a Czech fencer, an Olympic fencer.
Nice.
An accent. That's the only other accent I know that's famous. So,
well, you're the second one that I've met that's famous. How's that?
There you go.
Okay, so we're gonna get to know you, and just from what you said, like I know nothing about my podcast and my guests, but just from what you've said, I already know because I have a history of photography as well. I mean, the whole podcast was born really out of a photo project that I'd done. You know, Shooting It Raw is a phrase. Not from porn. It's a phrase from digital photography. Yeah, let's go into your first photo. Yeah?
Yeah, okay.
Sweet, okay. And I don't look at them beforehand, right?
So okay, cool.
I loved how I have no idea what I'm going to see. And yeah, you understand photography just a little. So the photo, so what I have to do is I have to kind of explain. So it's called... Okay. Chimborazo?
Oh, then that one is just mislabeled. That's my Hawaii photograph. Okay.
Yeah, so that's what it... Yeah, the landscape looks like volcanic earth. And what's really beautiful is the cloud cover, which looks like maybe it's... Maybe like 400 or 500 meters up is just over... Or just kissing the top of the mountainous... It's not even mountainous. Hilly, like really kind of dramatic hills. There's the bush with a little bit of red flowers on the left. And there's a highway, beautiful highway. It seems to cut right into the mountain. Maybe not. You have no idea what this is. So what is this?
Yeah, so this is the Stairway to Heaven on Oahu. It's illegal hike, but it is a gorgeous hike. It's like there's an old radar dome at the top of this mountain that has these stairs that go all the way up it. And it's been closed down for a long time, but if you get around, you can get up there, and it's probably some of the most beautiful views of all of Oahu.
Mm-hmm.
So this is where I lived for a couple years on Oahu, and I had done this hike early. This is first thing in the morning. The sun is just coming up.
Oh, okay.
If you were looking towards the right of that photograph, my house would be down that way about a mile.
Oh, wow.
I'd take that road to work. It is a tunnel through the mountains. I take that road to work
wicked.
Every day. So, yeah.
Okay, so I just watched a movie, Riding Giants. So are you a surfer at all? Or?
You know, when I was a kid, I did. I didn't surf much in Hawaii.
Yeah, you know, the surfing in Hawaii is supposed to be really shit from what I understand.
Yeah, it's like there's some places like, but a lot of the places I tried to go surfing is kind of like a locals only kind of deal. And even though I lived there, it didn't quite qualify.
Okay. So you opened this door. We're talking about Hawaii, this hike up to this beautiful, I mean, it's about as spectacular as, you know, like they shot the movie, like the Lord of the Rings in New Zealand because of the dramatic landscape. And so, I mean, this is that kind of, or Lost, right? They shot Lost on
yeah, this is actually, this is where they shot a lot of Jurassic Park, the first one.
Ah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's really stunning. Well, Sir Lance, why? Oh, actually, oh, guess what? I just realized. First of all, this podcast will be the first of 2024. So look, we're recording for the future. So congratulations. The other thing is that the other guest that I've had on the podcast connected to Hawaii was also Czech.
Really?
Yeah.
That is a strange coincidence. That's pretty cool.
Okay. So, okay. But again, going back, why start with this really gorgeous, dramatic photograph?
Yeah, so we just left from this place. Like, we just moved from Hawaii. We're living in California. And so, like, now we are. I don't know. Hawaii, as far as inside of America goes, it's where I feel most at home. I was actually born in Central America. And the culture in Hawaii is the closest to the culture from, you know, where I grew up. So there's something about Hawaii that really, you know, clicks with me as far as feeling like home. So I think this picture.
Okay. Okay. So we know that you're a photographer or you have a link to photography. You obviously know how to make beautiful photographs, but to a certain extent, in a way, like that landscape under the right light, you knew to take your camera up for the morning shot. You have this like crazy sky.
Yeah.
So what's your relationship to landscape photography?
Yeah, that's actually where I was. Landscape and nature photography was kind of like my first interest in photography, because ever since I graduated high school back in 2006, I've traveled a lot. I spent the next, you know, after I graduated, I spent the next 10 years or so traveling around Southeast Asia and South America. And I didn't bring a camera with me on any of those trips except for like one of them. I didn't want to. I wanted it to be entirely my experience to be encapsulated by, being in the moment, not experiencing it through a lens or anything. Mm-hmm. But I kept seeing these things that I was like, these beautiful landscapes that I wanted to remember. And so that's where I first got a camera, was to start trying to take pictures of some of the things that the landscape, the nature that I saw.
Yeah, for sure. What do you do in California that keeps you busy?
I'm a teacher. I'm a eighth grade history teacher at the moment.
Okay. 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 So let's go back to Hawaii. Okay. So, you know, I think to a certain extent, like, we're shaped as much by our environment than, you know, as by experience. And obviously our experiences within in the environment. And so normally I record podcasts from Hong Kong. At the moment, I'm in Savannah, Georgia. So,
oh wow, that's my wife's family is from just 45 minutes north of Savannah, Georgia.
Okay, So if we look at Hawaii in terms of how it shaped you, so have you done a lot of traveling that you would? Because to a certain extent, once you go outside of the U.S., you understand. And living in Hawaii, from what I've heard, is sufficiently different that people go like, yeah, there's like, you know, like the continental US is one thing, but the mentality in Hawaii is different. Whereas the mentality outside of the US, of course, is going to be different. So why don't you talk about that?
So like Hawaii is incredibly unique in its history and its culture. So like it still has Hawaii's history alone, if you're trying to understand like why it is so unique, you kind of have to look into its history a little bit. It's very recently become part of the United States. It was its own country for a long, long time, had and they still have a very strong connection to their monarchy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the culture of like caring for the land and caring for the sea and the connection between them and like the native Hawaiians and the land is something that's still very strong and very prevalent.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like there's a bit of like in the history of like American imperialism and how Hawaii became part of the United States really plays into a lot of the current culture and what's going on and everything there. And so it kind of takes a lot of the political sphere as well as like the cultural sphere, and they're both highlighted in different aspects of everyday life in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm. So as somebody who teaches history, did you study history?
Mm-hmm. That's actually, that's how I got my publicist actually sent me over, because I wrote a book, and not sure how he came across your podcast, but he sent me, or you sent him. I'm not sure. He sent me info, got us connected together. So
yeah, well, that's sort of sometimes publicists connect us. And in your case, I think this is great. I mean, for me, it's all okay. So again, the podcast is about saying, okay, look, here's your life. How do you spend your time? So in your case, mm-hmm. you're shaped growing up in Hawaii, and then did you grow up in Hawaii or
no? I only lived in Hawaii. I lived in Hawaii for about 3 years.
Okay. Okay.
That's just my most recent move was from Hawaii to California.
Got it. Okay. So, sometimes I get authors on the podcast because authors have had to focus on expressing a story or their story or some kind of story within a narrative. Mm-hmm. And so I have photography and writing. So I'm also within the writing world. And so... first of all, we have to promote your book. What's the name of the book?
Yeah, it's called Youth Group, Coming of Age in the Church of Christian Nationalism. It's essentially a book that highlights how Christian nationalism, how evangelicalism became the primary force inside of Republican politics, and kind of highlighting my contributions to that process. It mm-hmm. shows, because I grew up in a very staunch evangelical household, very much Christian nationalists, and kind of how I came up in that, came out of that, and mm-hmm. so it kind of chronicles my life as well as the history of Christian nationalism inside of America.
Boom! this is a lot to chew on. Okay, look, we're going to get back to that. So please say the title of your book slowly, and it's going to be in the show notes, a link to the book. What is it?
Okay, it is Youth Group, Coming of Age in the Church of Christian Nationalism.
Okay, by Lance Axmit.
That's correct.
The podcast flies through because it's framed around your photos. We're just going to keep going.
Perfect.
So the one I have here is, Anna and Fia.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Anna.
Yeah.
Anna and Fia. Okay. So it's a photograph in what looks to me like, unfortunately, I've been poisoned by you saying that you're in California, that it looks like the Pacific Northwest more than the Pacific Southwest. But it could, because mm-hmm. the two people in the photo, it's a cute photo of a very, I'd say a toddler, like 2 to 3 years old, mm-hmm. Just walking and discovering the forest, the big, beautiful trees of the West Coast. And a woman, sensibly Anna, is walking mm-hmm. with hands in pockets. So it's probably a little bit cool. Hair in a ponytail, wearing a jacket, wearing a backpack. And then the trail is like covered in reddish pine needles, I guess. It's a bit of shrub, but there are large, tall trees all around. Maybe not California, maybe Oregon or Washington. What's this?
This is Northern California.
Okay.
This is not too far from the coast up and not too far from, I think we were close to Eureka at this place. So yeah, it was the Redwoods and we were hiking towards the coast.
Nice.
We had been, I don't know, that's my daughter Fia. She, at this time when this picture was taken, we were on a little bit of vacation from Hawaii to California. And she was about 2 years old at this time, almost. And she kind of grown up going on hikes. And so I decided that this was a good exemplar of the things we enjoy doing. And this is my little family.
Right. Nice. Well, okay. So like how my family overlays with your family is I have a daughter who, you know, and like her mother is from British Columbia. So BC, so the forest, it's all there. We've always done tons of hiking. So this photograph to me is very familiar. It's that that idea of, you know, the two in front and me behind to make the photograph as you were. Mm. So you know, because I'm like a writer kind of person as well, I'm like, well, everything's a kind of a story, right? Yeah. So the first chapter of the story was this beautiful landscape in Hawaii. The second chapter is this beautiful, intimate photo of your wife and your daughter together. And so you're this this small cluster of family of you three. What's in this chapter?
Yeah, I think so. It kind of expresses for me the very insular nature of our life thus far. Like we are we are very much a kind of like a unit of three. We've traveled a lot just since my daughter was born. Mm-hmm. She was born in Hawaii, and then we lived in Ecuador for about 9 months. And
Wow.
We traveled in an RV from Savannah, Georgia, actually, all the way to Northern California, where this picture was taken.
Dude, this is too funny.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, this picture was taken was then, and then we flew back to Hawaii after that because we decided to go back to Hawaii for my wife's job for a little bit before we mm-hmm. ended up back here in California. So it's like we're very much like we don't really have much of our own community yet. So we're all very close, and it's great, but we're right now this next chapter is us trying to establish some form of community somewhere, and we're trying to figure out where that's going to be.
Got it. So was this pre-COVID?
This was mid-COVID, So like what happened was in Hawaii, she was born in 2020. So COVID was just exploding real bad.
Oh, wow.
And we didn't know what was going to go on. We thought the housing market was going to collapse. Anna's job was in jeopardy. So we sold our house in Hawaii and we moved to a place in Ecuador where COVID was very, very, like the numbers were almost non-existent up in the mm-hmm. mountains. That's where I wrote my book, actually, was up in the mountains.
Oh, wow.
And then when things kind of calmed down a bit, that's when we came back to the States.
Well, look at you. What a smarty pants you are. That's where I wrote my book, actually. So bring it back to your book. okay. First of all, explain to me, please, because I am not American. I am not Christian. I'm not, mm-hmm. like we have some things that are really close in terms of how you and I are experienced. But for example, what is evangelical culture world that you kind of broke free from?
Oh, well, that's
that you'd write a book about it.
It took me quite a few chapters to explain. Mm-hmm. So what is the evangelical world view is essentially evangelicalism in America today is a conflation between religious and cultural norms. So like a lot of the evangelical, what we would call evangelical culture, are not things that are based in any form of what we'd say doctrine or mm-hmm. It is based in doctrine, but like scripture and things. A lot of it is purely cultural, and so they're trying to. And that's where Christian nationalism and evangelicalism kind of combine. They're trying to start to enforce their own cultural worldviews onto everybody else.
Okay.
So like what. I kind of tackled the subject from a bit of a humorous standpoint because I grew up in the late '00s when like youth group and evangelical like youth activities were at their like peak of ridiculousness, like the things mm-hmm. that we would do in church lock-ins and just stuff like that was so like anyone who would hear some of the things or read some of them in the book would be like, this is real life. People did this stuff. Like we would have CD immolation parties, not CD burning parties where we copy music, but we'd literally have a 50 gallon drum where everyone bring their secular music, their worldly music, mm-hmm. their CDs, put them into the drum and put gasoline on them and burn them. Right.
Okay.
Because we were separating ourselves from the world.
Right.
That sort of thing. We'd have evangelical, like where we go and evangelize to people on the street, where we'd have like big conventions where people from all over the Midwest would meet and with the goal of like harassing an entire town for 2 or 3 days. Wow. That sort of stuff.
What a nice way of putting it. So look, just to give you my, like, so here's, so I was born in Israel. And so, on the spectrum of religiosity in my family, there's secular or atheist, this is me, to the bonkers, the equivalent of evangelical, like orthodox, hyper-orthodox, like just completely bonkers, I guess, of seeing the world. Okay. Oh, I have so many questions for you. Okay, so let's start with writing. Where... To sit down and write a book, right? Well, you're stuck in Ecuador, so it's like, okay, you have the space and you have the time and you have the whatever. But mm-hmm. where did that inclination or impulse go to sit down and say, okay, I'm going to shape this into chapters, into a book?
Oh, I had I've always written, and I had a collection of different like short like little stories that had happened to me from when I was traveling or from when I was a kid that. I had written down at some point, and I started noticing a trend and a connection between the different stories and different things that I was found important enough to write down. And so I saw the connection there. And I also at the same time had recently kind of more publicly come out of evangelicalism.
I'm just laughing with you, man.
Yeah, no, it's true. So like I started coming out of evangelicalism. And so like I did a lot of research, a lot of history and studying, and I knew the history because history is always what I studied in college and stuff to become a teacher and stuff. So I knew a lot of the history of how Christianity was used around the world as far as American imperialism and that sort of stuff. And I started looking closer into what I had believed and the history behind that. And I found it fascinating, and I was like taking notes and stuff. I was like, I could combine this with my story because there's some parallels, and decided to do it. And then I pitched it to, I don't know, several hundred publishers until one picked it up.
Okay, nice. Well, that's how it always seems to go.
Right.
So this is your first book or your second?
Yes,
or
first?
Well done, sir. Well done.
Thank you.
Okay. So let's go back to, so it's very dangerous to go study history. It's like, it'd be like, how can you, I don't understand how a scientist, like a true scientist, could become a scientist and not actually become, then not question everything. So in my case, it would lead to a certain crisis, intellectual crisis of, religion never resonated with me. Even as a kid. So in your case, so where did your sort of detachment from the evangelical sort of narrative or story or culture or presence in your life, how did you detach and then get the courage or the impulse to just say, okay, that's...
Yeah. No, I mean, there's no, that's one thing. It's like, there's a series of small events that lead to a watershed moment kind of deal, right? So I think some of the earliest ones, there was never really a choice for me as far as when I was a kid on whether or not this resonated with me or not. I was a Christian, and that was the truth. And anyone else outside it who didn't know that either needed to be saved or they were actively trying to keep me from doing God's work on Earth. So those were my options there.
Wow.
But even when I believed that, there was I always felt really guilty about certain things that came natural to me. For example, I always hated evangelizing to people. I hated trying to get someone, it did not feel loving. It was supposed to be a loving experience. You're supposed to be showing your love and God's love to people by trying to get them to heaven, right? I just absolutely hated it. And I felt terrible about that. I was I feel like this is the most cringy, awful thing to be doing. And I couldn't quite understand why, because in my ideology, it should have been the best thing. And so there was that little split that started early on. Also, I always, the people I disliked the most were always the most Christian people. we used to, in school, we'd have to do what we called sword drills, which was they would tell us a Bible verse, and we'd have our Bibles in our hands, above our heads. And then whoever brought it down and opened it to that verse and read it the first got prize or whatever, right? We call them sword drills because, and as it was explained by my teacher, was that soon you won't even have to think of anything. When something happens to you, the scripture will immediately come to your mind.
Right.
And that, that was the idea. And I remember thinking but I really don't like people who quote scripture all the time. Those people are the worst people.
Yeah,
so I remember even then being I don't want to be that person either.
Yeah.
And the other really big one was in church. So in church, we'd always have someone who would share, a lot of times we have somebody who share their testimony, which is essentially their story of before they were Christian, then when they became a Christian, what they're doing now, right? And I always, and I can't think of a single one where I wasn't disappointed at the point where they became a Christian, because when they became a Christian, all of a sudden their stories became way less interesting and incredibly boring. Whereas their lives beforehand were usually something pretty interesting and fun to hear about. And so I was that's probably not a good sign either.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So in terms of let's get into the nitty gritty of your book though. How old is your book?
It just came out last year. Less than a year ago. Actually, it came out this year, but it's about to be last year, I suppose.
And so how do, how, cause look, I think like all art, you know, and to write even a nonfiction book, it is a sort of artistic piece, you know. It's like you never know how it's going to land, right? Like you kind of send it off and it's like, there goes my baby. And some hits, some miss, you know, very much like this podcast maybe. But like what from the publication surprised you?
Yeah, I think one thing that really surprised me, very practically speaking, was that the majority of books that are published sell under 250 copies.
Mm-hmm.
I just had, I don't know, made my
That's
assumption.
A sobering reality, isn't it?
Exactly, right? And I was like, when I first started looking into it, I was like, 250 copies? Like, is that even, like, worth this endeavor? Like, I mean,
exactly.
Like there's no money coming. That's not even about to even pay for like anything, right? So it's like,
mm-hmm.
And I found that out early on, thankfully,
right.
Because like I wasn't so disappointed later on. Yeah. Like I did do better than the average. I feel good about that. But like just the reality that like people spend so much time and effort creating something about and putting something out about themselves or putting out this work that, you know, very few people ever get to read. You know, I always thought like, yeah, maybe 1,000, 2,000 copies
right.
was average. Like, nah.
And it's funny that like if you listen to somebody like the woman who wrote, what's it called, Harry Potter. J.K. Rowling.
Yeah.
So when they printed her first book, it was like they printed 500 copies and they thought, well, maybe we'll sell that much. We doubt it. Mm-hmm. And it's like it sold bazillions, right? So
yes.
It's really hard to – it's so hard to know. So again, you're speaking. You're telling me this tale. We're talking about the book. We're talking about – but then also this photo of – and really I'm looking at your little unit, your little family. There's mm-hmm. you on the left in video and then there's your daughter – arms up high, mid stride. So that's a perfect, really. Actually, both your daughter and Anna are mid stride, which is just like perfectly timed as far as photographs go. So it really kind of conveys motion. So I'll let you say one more thing about this photo, and then we'll move on to the next. What do you think?
I guess the last thing about this photo the memory attached to it, at least, was this was one of the last bit of time before both my wife and I went back to work and stuff.
Mm.
And just the feeling of being able to do what you wanted to do inside of a time frame, like you're not without the constraints of like, I have to work here. I've got these hours and things. It's like, these kind of memories are what drive me to try and find a way of balancing my life and where work is not central, you know?
Got it. Spoken like a true Hawaiian / Californian. Okay, next photo. Okay, there we go. Okay, so in this photograph, dude, your photos are great. Okay, so half the image is sky with the clouds very low to the ground, right? In the sense that these are high clouds and yet there's mountain peaks, and the mountain peaks in the background, there's snow on them. The rocks are super craggy, like there's nothing green on them, nothing alive. In the foreground, in this beautiful tan brown color, is light grass, slight shrub, and this one desert chicken that's humongous. What is that?
This guy down here?
Yeah, it's not a desert chicken. I'm just kidding.
It's a vicuña. It's a vicuña, which is a subspecies of alpaca.
Ah, alpaca. Okay. So a vicuña.
Yeah, V-E-C-U-N-A, I believe.
Okay. How's your Spanish?
My Spanish is not nearly as good as when I was a kid, but okay. It's okay.
Okay. So why so put yourself for a second in the listener's imagination or in my experience as well, in the sense of that I don't know what's where we're going. And then we started off in Hawaii, went to California, and now we're in like in this place where vicuñas, I guess, live mm-hmm. on hillsides. What's this all about?
Well, this is a little more than a hillside. This is Chimborazo, the mountain I was telling about before. This is the mm-hmm. tallest mountain in, I believe, the Western Hemisphere. It's 20-some thousand feet.
Okay.
It's very, like, up here was you know, walking was hard to do. And this is one of the few places that the vicuña live. Like, they just roam around this area.
Oh, wow.
And this was in Ecuador. Ecuador holds a really special part of my my heart. It was something I wasn't expecting when I got there, because, you know, I grew up in Central America and stuff. And so I thought it was going to be very similar to where I was from. It is in a lot of ways, but also there's something very unique and wild about the entire country. And the culture of a lot of, like, the indigenous people who live there, and how much also is very similar with Hawaii as well, is the care for the land and the different social reforms that are trying, they were at the time that we were there, were trying to push through and stuff. It was just a very, there's so much going on there, and so much that I that aligned itself with the things I care about as well, that I you know, got swept up in it all.
I love that. Okay, so different people, I say to them, pick four photos. They pick four photos, and some people, it's like they have a very conscious agenda. You know, they're like, this is what I want to talk about, and which isn't to say that you don't, but they're not necessarily photographers. So, but being a kind of a photographer type person, I really respond to visual, like compositions, light, all this stuff, and so this lone animal. Is no, there's another one in the distance, actually. Or maybe two other ones, small.
Yeah, if
small
you look real close, you might be able to find probably two or three way back there.
Yeah, and so so there's a lot of space between them. Mm-hmm. There's no high grasses. They're little shrubs, little grasses. The light is very kind of, in a way, soft and diffuse, and it's like the tone of the image is also really beautiful, in the sense of it's these beautiful tans as far as what is earthy in terms of where the animal is. And then there's you. So in that day that you were there, in terms of, like, in your brain, when you're faced with the invitation, like, bring about four photos, and your brain, for whatever, even if it's like, is there truly random? I don't know. But so you selected this image. So yeah, like, what else does it mean? Like, if you dig a little bit into its symbolism, like, what are we learning here?
Yeah, I think the four photos that I selected were primarily picked because the emotions that I attached to them when I took them were all very similar. Mm. So they're not like the best pictures I have. They're not the best composed, or even like the one later on that's, I think, even slightly blurry. But, like, it's about how I was feeling when I took them. In this picture, it's in particular, it was like I was seeing something I'd never seen before.
Mm-hmm.
It was something in a place I had never imagined, some place that felt very alien. And I'm always the most comfortable when I'm in a place that is incredibly alien to me. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel the most, maybe not comfortable isn't the word, but the most me. I feel like the most genuine when I'm in a really alien environment.
Okay. Like an outsider, in a way.
Yeah, yeah. And so, like, that's where I feel very happy. I feel very secure. And the one picture that I felt that way but was not in a kind of an alien environment was the one where it was my daughter and my wife.
Okay.
But still had a very similar feeling.
Sure.
When I took it, so.
So, what, like, even then, like even that image is of solitude. You know, it's of being in a space where there is this kind of solitude. And so here, like, when you're on this hillside, so for those people who are on the metric system, this is about 7,000 meters?
Yeah, something like that, 20,000 feet.
Just under, 6,000, so between 6,000 and 7,000 meters. What was there altitude sickness? How long did it take for you to hike up to this place? Like, what was the impact on your body to be out there?
It was pretty tough. Luckily there is like a base camp that's not too far from this location, where there's a, you know, like a ranger and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It took me maybe if I was at sea level, would it take me maybe like an hour? It took me like four to get to the spot. But it was really tough. I was chewing on some, you know, the coca leaves, the cocaine leaves, altitude sickness, which really did help.
Oh, wow.
But But yeah, no, it was tough, but it was, every step was like, I couldn't stop because everything I would see was something different. And if you see that little peak in the background, you can see some snow on the top of it.
Behind it, yeah.
This picture is the very first time I saw the peak, because up to this point, it was completely covered in clouds. All I could see was the grass. As soon as I saw a little bit of sky open up and I could see the peak in the background, I snapped a picture.
Yeah. So you said that somebody gave you some coca leaves. Were you part of a group? Were you had a guide?
No. It was just my wife and my daughter. My daughter was sleeping in the car because it's so high. You don't want to spend too much time with a young child up that high.
No, of course.
They kind of stayed in the car, and I went on a hike while she was napping and my wife was reading. And so we walked around a little bit, and then I went and kept on going and taking some pictures.
Okay. So I can't help myself. Somebody who goes running or hiking, trail running, trail hiking, is essentially in their own head.
Yeah.
There's a certain solitude in there, right? And then, so you go out onto this hill and there's this one human, like Homo sapien, walking around with his little tool, which is a camera or whatever, and his bags and other tools. And he's sort of taking in the landscape, but fundamentally in his own head, in his own self, right? So I'm going to bring this back to your book. So what happened? So you're going through this experience and to a certain extent feeling alienation about the culture that you're surrounded by, where you're like, I'm in this weird landscape where people are just kind of like bringing down books because they can nail the right verse or whatever it is. And I feel really alien here. So why don't you talk about your what are your internal drivers? That, because writing a book is totally a solitary thing. Like you have to get a room of your own, nice and quiet, sit.
It's true.
So why don't you talk about like, what's your relationship to your own solitude?
Yeah. Solitude is something I've always prized and valued highly in my life. I think a lot of it is probably, I come from a family of four sisters and then I was the only boy.
Oh, okay.
So like there was a lot of time spent like playing by myself as a kid just because like my sisters, not that they were, you know.
Are you the youngest?
No, I have one sister younger than me.
Okay, so wait, I have to interrupt. I bought a Subway yesterday from Subway and the guy behind the counter, I'm very friendly. Talking to the guy, he's like, he surprisingly knew where Hong Kong was. And he was like, yeah, I just got my passport. I've told my girlfriend, my fiance, we're going to travel. I'm like, oh, good for you. Like, get out. You need to get out. And he was the only boy with other four sisters.
Oh, wow.
But he was he was either the youngest or the eldest. I forget that point.
It's tough when you're growing up with, you know, with four sisters and they all kind of like form their own little unit. And then that's you.
I treat you as the doll?
Yeah, like you're the doll or in my case, I was the guinea pig. So like if they found something they wanted to do, but they weren't sure if it was dangerous, they'd have me go into the earth kind of stuff. Like we watched Mary Poppins and they weren't sure if actually you could float with an umbrella. So they gave me an umbrella and tossed me off the roof kind of deal.
Well, obviously you made it. So well done.
I made it. Yeah. So, but you can't float. The umbrella turns inside out. So don't try it, guys.
Of course. Okay. So why don't you, like, in terms of that, if there are switches in your head that go on and off depending on, you know, the circumstance, right? Like, for example, you have a very small, tight family, tight-knit family. Like, talk about those deeper levels. Like, was writing your book, what's the title again?
It is Youth Group, Coming of Age in the Church of Christian Nationalism.
A very light, easy, party-going title. Dude, that's a very heavy title. So it switches in your head in terms of would go off for you to write this book and to publish it, because that's a different task than to actually writing, right? But then to go on hikes. So why don't you connect, or if you can, try to connect growing up, only boy within within that whole world. Like, why don't you share that in terms of what are the switches in your brain that go off to make you kind of grab your camera, go out, or...
So, like, I always sought out solitude or sought out adventures that I partook in by myself. So, like, when I went to... After high school, I knew I didn't want to go to college, mostly just because everybody else was going. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, I'm not going to do that. Eventually ended up going, but it took me about 10 years. I instead went to Vietnam. I bought a one-way ticket to Vietnam and had a backpack. I got rid of everything that I owned and just had a backpack with a few things in it and went to Southeast Asia and hiked around, just kind of backpacked through Southeast Asia, you know, the traditional backpacker thing. At the time, I thought I was like completely unique in doing, of course, everyone does when they're that age. Right. They're kind of a unique butterfly in how they do things. But
choosing Vietnam, though, I mean, that's like what drew you to Vietnam?
Vietnam, I think Vietnam, it was its place in American history. Like it's this quagmire that America got itself into. And there's so much, you know, I grew up watching like Chuck Norris movies and Uncommon Valor, like all these movies that featured Vietnam negatively. But something about it, like something about the mystery of like this place that seemingly stood against everything I knew up to that point about like America, like America's invincibility, its exceptionalism, and yet somehow what happened, like Vietnam didn't, it does, something about it just didn't stand out, like stood out in a way that didn't make sense to me, which had always intrigued me, so I picked Vietnam.
And I think am I interrupting? I don't mean to interrupt.
No yeah, it was essentially from there. I experiencing it alone and going from like group to group of people, there were people who like immediately accepted me in as like a fellow traveler, and that made me felt like I felt very much like I was accepted, as well as feeling, you know, the solitude, and it was a great experience for me.
Nice. Well, on that note, shall we go on to the next photo?
Let's do it.
Tell you, man, it's flying by far too quickly. Make it come back. Oh, man, come on. Very cute. Okay. So this looks like you're a really good photographer. Even the shit photograph, you're like, well, you know, these aren't so great. Bada bee, bada bang. The light is beautiful. The moment is beautiful. So there is, okay, the... How should I put this? There's what looks to me like an adolescent Asian elephant kind of sitting on its rump against a hillside. And behind this adolescent elephant is a toddler elephant with its brand new little, I mean, it looks like it's less than a year old, spanking little trunk, just kind of sitting there. Two sisters, brother and sister, siblings, who knows? Probably not siblings, but... the two young elephants, elephants in Thailand. So, why?
Yeah. They actually are sisters. The little elephant's name was Sunday. I don't remember the bigger one, her name. This is the picture that like the it was overexposed. My camera settings were weird, but I was there and I took the picture. But I really loved it because this was one of the, it was a really special experience for me. So I went and worked in Thailand a few years ago. It was like 2016. I guess it doesn't matter too much. But I worked with a captive elephant group. I did experiential education where kids would come and learn different aspects of what it was like for the captive elephants in Thailand, and what some of the issues were facing, the people who were raising them, the elephants, the ethical questions of like tourism, all these different things.
Right. Was this part of Elephant Nature Park or a different one?
No, it was close to where Elephant Nature Park is, though. It's just actually down the road a little ways.
Look at that.
Yeah, like, so these guys, we were out there with them, and I don't know, the humanity inside of elephants is amazing.
Which is a funny sentence, but yeah.
Right, exactly. there are a lot more, they're much more people than a lot of people I know. And this was a really important time for me because like I came up against a really tough decision shortly after this picture was taken, where I found out that the organization, so I was working inside of an elephant camp, but I was hired by a different organization.
Okay.
Right. So I was working inside this camp, and I found that this camp was kind of, they were greenwashing a lot of the stuff that they were doing. They weren't being as ethical or above board as they were saying, but the people who are working there were still very, very good people, and they were depending upon the organization that I was working with for like income. And it was just a very, very complex situation of trying to figure out how to find a solution, and ended up coming up with, I guess, the best situation that could be. But yeah, it was just like a really tough call for me, ethically, trying to figure out what best to do. It turns out they were supposed to be rescuing elephants, but they're actually breeding them.
Right.
And so like we got a whole bunch of stuff involved, and we got my organization changed their policies. This camp so said they were changing their policies. It turned out best way possible I can imagine, but it was a monumentous occasion for me.
Right. Right. Lance, it's really nice to meet you. This is great. Okay. So yeah. So having been around, you know, elephant, well, in Thailand a bunch, and understanding and learning a lot about like sort of elephant biology and how they grow. It's like, yeah, you see a toddler elephant, that's like a toddler human. You see an adolescent elephant, it's like an adolescent human in terms of the lifespan, development, and all this stuff. Not to say that we're the same, but there is something really powerful about connecting with this other being that cross species, whatever you want to call it, but it's just like, oh, wait a second. That makes you very introspective. Okay. Now here's the big question that makes no sense. How do you connect your emotional response to the work that you were doing in Thailand to the book you're writing?
I think the experience of being over there and being faced and forced with like these moral and ethical questions and not being able to just let it lie, but come up with a solution that I could exist with is very similar to my experience with, you know, coming out of evangelicalism, right? Like I could have just let it lie and just been nominally a Christian for forever and things would have been much easier, but that's not my personality, and it's not
right,
you know. If there is a connection, I think that might be it.
So when you gravitated towards, so you studied history in college, you studied something else?
Yeah, I studied international relations, but with a heavy emphasis on history.
Okay. So yeah, so for example, in terms of the work that I've done for many years, it was, and the work I'm doing now, you know, is basically to look at, you know, what we, to sum it up, is that we say that to be a great service network leader and become a service leader is to have high competence, high character, and high care. So that you care is that you're worried about your tribe, you're worried about your environment, you're worried about the people, not worried, but you're caring about what's around you, the people around you. Your competence is you have the expertise to do what you want to do, that you know how to do things correctly. And then character is this idea that, you know, you can build trust, but also you're coming from a strong ethical, moral background, right? So listening to you talk, like with those filters in front of my face and listening to you talk, what I see is a person or a being, a fellow human who has morality and ethics and all this stuff as a real kind of foundation or core value that is just like, so for example, other people may have responded to this ethical dilemma with the elephants and go, meh, not my problem. And yet with you, it's like, no, hold on a second. I'm facing this. And then that same reflex is what made you write your book, right? So why don't you talk, and because you're an educator, so this is back on you, like, why don't you talk about how ethics, morality, the distance you've crossed and traveled, how you bring that to the classroom?
I think when it comes to like different ethical and moral questions, it's very easy to connect that with, you know, because I teach social studies and history. So like those, like the dilemmas that a lot of people, you know, face today have been faced a million times throughout history, even the ones we learn about inside of, you know, U.S. history at the moment, which is what I'm teaching, are at just a much grander scale. So I think it's oftentimes, you know, history is taught without really considering the dilemmas that people were being faced with. Like, why did they choose this over that? A lot of times it's taught through a very basic window, especially inside of eighth grade, of just being like, oh, they chose this because it benefited them this amount. Like, it doesn't incorporate deeper and more you know, controversial, frankly, ethical questions that were being faced. It's like, well, if it has anything to do with imperialism, it's because the people who did it were racist and bad. Like, well, those things might be true, but also there's some
not very nuanced.
Yeah, there's like some deeper nuanced questions that we should be looking at. Like, would you guys be any different having grown up inside of this system 100 years ago? The odds are people were. You can see that people were and that they fought against it, but the odds are the majority of you would not be. Like, whenever I'm teaching kids, they're always like, why would they do that? I'm like, well, maybe one of you in this room might not have at that time, but so.
Yeah, maybe one of you in this room might write a book like mine. You're like, why are you selling me this book?
Yeah, that's another thing I'm not excited for, because there's some things in this book that would be kind of weird for an eighth grader to know about their teacher. So none of them have read it so far, but I'm
well. Kinda... I've talked about this book as an important sort of book for authors, for writers. It's called Three Steps on the Ladder of Writing, and it's a book about what it is to be a writer, right? Mm. And so, to a certain extent, when you sit at your desk, as you did, right, is that you have to be fearless. Like, you have to be like, come what may, fuck the world, I'm putting it down. And then, like, so for example, one author I'd met, she was told she was going to die. And so she was a writer in India, right? And she wrote nonfiction. And so they said, okay, write your final nonfiction book. So in the hospital, she wrote her last sort of dying book, where she just laid it all out, and it got published, but she got healthy. She got better. So then all of a sudden she's like, oh, fuck. So in the same way, like, I think to be fearless, of course, and to write your truth or whatever it is. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure in between the lines with your students, they're going to pick up on the fact that their teacher is a badass. Like, you know, no, it's really great. Okay, how do we wrap this all up? From Hawaii to California, to Venezuela or Ecuador?
Ecuador.
Ecuador to Thailand. Okay. Luckily, I can just ask that question and say to you, okay, how, if life is a kind of a narrative or a story, what is that story?
Oh, man. If life is a narrative, what is the narrative? Judging from some of the photos I've chosen, whatever the subconscious or consciously, and the book that I've written, I would imagine that if life is a story, it's a story about coming up against systems and coming up against systems and people and ethical dilemmas, and not shying away from them, but looking at things as they are and doing the best that you can, and making your decisions based on your ethics, based on what you believe to be true, as opposed to what you believe or what you want to be, would make your life easier. Which is a hard lesson to learn, but I think that's, if that was my story that connects all these things, I think that's the connection.
So I worked with a co-founder of DHL, and the DHNL were from the US, but the co-founder was from Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. Is from Hong Kong. And through him, I got really exposed to a lot of this sort of idea of there's something about being American, about the American culture, American way of thinking, of talking. We talk about what's important to us. And as a historian, as a person who teaches history, as a person who's been exposed to that, like, there's a really strong moral branch, fiber, pool, book, whatever, chapter in you that really comes out. And so do you think that was something that was encultured from your culture, or was it encultured from your, as a family value, or is it just something that you cobbled together out of experience going, no, wait a second, I sleep better at night by making these tough decisions?
A little bit of A, a little bit of B. I think that a lot of it is like So one of the things that kind of started making me turn away from evangelicalism and Christianity as a whole was the morals and ethics that were being taught to me as, you know, in Sunday school, the basics of you know, kindness and treating other people as you'd care to be treated, was not only being betrayed by Christianity's biggest proponents, but was being betrayed by the God of the Bible, right? So, like, when you are reading about these monstrosities that were committed at the behest of this god, and you're like, okay, there's certain sects and certain, you know, strains of Christianity that have explained those away and make those into allegories or make those into people trying to understand God or whatever, and that's fine. But as far as my branch, evangelicals, they believe in the inerrant word of God. So like,
right,
they're saying,
right, literally,
yeah, that God told these people to do these terrible things, and it's like, well, yeah, that's a monster, right? Like, yeah, this is like, that is that's terrible. So like, yep, these ethics that you guys are teaching me are betrayed by the person that, or the being that you're saying is giving them to you. Like, so that contradiction, I think, was very,
yeah,
while it was taught to me through biblical means, I think it also taught me to abandon.
Well, you matured like a mature human being. And to a certain extent, I would say that the people, be they Christian or Jewish or Muslim, who believe those fairy tales are fundamentally immature. And that's just me. Listen, that's just me. That can land on me. Lance, one more time, the title of your book. We're going to sell those copies.
All right, that'd be great. Let's, you can buy them on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, I think even Walmart, yeah, I don't know. It is Youth Group, Coming of Age in the Church of Christian Nationalism. And if anybody does want to buy it, try and find it at a local bookstore. Ask them to send it to you as opposed to Amazon, if that's
nice, Lance. Nice. Respect. Thank you so much. Thank you.
No, thank you. It's been a lot of fun.
Bye.
Have a good one.
Shooting it raw?
Yes. Shooting it raw. Oh, baby, I like it.